from GPB News. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. There are more homeless kids and teens in Atlanta than any other city in the South.
It's a day-to-day struggle. You can't think past today. You have to worry about the here and now and how you're supposed to survive through the night.
We'll talk about the challenges facing youth living on Atlanta's streets. But first, let's revisit a conversation we had about Georgia being a popular tourist spot for rodents. If you believe pest control experts at Terminix, Savannah is the most rodent-infested city in America. And some of you have stories about spotting these creatures, well, maybe some creatures in other places. Here are your first thoughts.
Hey, this is Bob. I have some dear friends from France. And when they were visiting a few years ago, we were driving and came around a curve and saw a very large possum crossing the road. And they were very excited and wanted to know what kind of animal it was. And I said, wow, that's a big rat. They were quite excited about the giant rats we have here in the South.
Rodents of unusual size? I don't think they exist. Thank you very much for that, Bob. Hopefully some furry friends are listening. Although they're not really tourists, right? They live here. You can call us with your own rodent stories or opossum stories. It's 404-500-9457. Or find us on social media and we might feature your comments on the show. Look, we've all seen it. Somebody shops while they're on their work computer when they're on the clock, or they take really long lunches, or they borrow supplies, take home a pack of Post-it notes. The workplace does not always foster the most ethical behavior. But new research from the University of Georgia shows it can be worse than that. Many employees lie on their timesheets and even trash their coworkers in order to get ahead. With me to discuss this study is Marie Mitchell, a professor of management in the Terry College of Business at UGA. Hi, Marie.
Hello.
And also with us is Karen Rommelfanger, a professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Emory University. Hi, Karen.
Hello.
So, Marie, let's talk about sort of the limitations of the study, right? What questions was it intended to answer?
Well, my colleagues and I were very interested in understanding what workplace cheating behavior would be. There's been quite a few studies about cheating, but primarily those studies occur in labs and experiments, and they're very informative. But what we wanted to know is, what are employees seeing? What are they actually doing in organizations? And so we conducted a study that asked employees across the nation about, just give us various examples of behaviors you have actually seen at work. And over 500 individuals gave us examples, and we kind of culled those down into various categories of cheating behavior. More than 50% of those examples were cheating where the individual is engaging in unethical behavior, self-interested behavior that alters their own work behavior, such as falsifying timesheets. And 30% were behaviors where individuals were cheating by undermining their coworkers for self-gain. The rest of them didn't really fall into what we believed were a category of cheating behavior, although they were definitely bad work behaviors. They're called deviant behaviors, where individuals are basically surfing the web. And in that respect, while it's bad, it's not cheating behavior because it wasn't really entered into for a purpose of self-gain. At least we didn't think so. So from that point, we decided to really unpack what's the reasons why employees are engaging in these behaviors.
And to interrupt you for just a second, any of our listeners can call in with things that you've seen as well. Some of them don't entirely qualify. Jane Moore tweets this: hands down for me, the worst thing she's seen was a coworker in a tiny two-person office who flossed her teeth at her desk. That's gross, Jane, but I don't think that's unethical.
No.
So, Karen, when we're talking about why people do this, is there a difference in the way we view behavior at the workplace as opposed to the way we view behavior just in our regular lives?
Well, I think in this context, well, first, by definition, cheating means you're breaking the rules.
Right.
Right? So the rules in various contexts are different. So in this case, I think there's a discussion of, or there's an assumption, and they're defined in the study as what is considered cheating. And it's a personal, a violation of what is, I think, in the paper states of global norms. And also, I think that I've seen Dr. Mitchell also speak about a violation of rules, legal rules.
Oh, right.
I actually disagree with the first one, because I think breaking a rule or a something that is legally deemed doesn't necessarily have to be unethical. For example, slavery was legal for a while, so I don't think that's sufficient.
Meaning that in your mind, the law is not always the best arbiter of ethics.
No.
Well, then let's go back to the study, Marie. And we also have things like, I think would qualify, Deanna Garcia tweets, when I worked at Starbucks, a shift manager would routinely take whole gallons of milk, mugs, glasses, and parts of gift sets. It was often just two of us, so to cover my butt, I snitched. And in this particular case, not only, it sounds like she's describing someone who's literally stealing, right, which is unethical, but it sounds like she's saying that she's told on this employee because she was trying to save herself also, which kind of fits into some of the motivations you discovered.
Well, I believe she's probably worried that her employer is going to blame her for the behavior. So in that respect, I wouldn't consider what she was doing as unethical, but it's definitely self-protective. In the study, what we find is that the reason why employees cheat is because of performance pressure. The idea that employees believe that they have to raise their performance efforts because they're linked to significant consequences, such as losing their job. And that creates and elicits self-protective emotions, such as anger and cognitions, which give them a really strong focus. So that whole need for self-protection is pretty innate to humans. And so it's not surprising that that particular employee wanted to protect herself also. But for different reasons than we found in our study for cheating behavior.
And there have been some pretty headline-grabbing cheating examples here in Georgia. We had the Atlanta Public Schools. Another international example is the Volkswagen scandal of 2015. Here's author Jack Ewing explaining to CBS why Volkswagen ended up doing what they did.
They were desperate to get back market share in the United States, and the way they thought they would do that was by selling diesels as an environmentally friendly technology. Yeah. But the engineers realized that they couldn't make the cars compliant with the U.S. rules, and so they came up with this cheat. I think they probably meant it as a short-term stopgap, but then it became a habit.
And Karen, this is interesting to me because Marie's talking about self-protective behavior. And to what extent do we justify unethical behavior so that we can accept it as not being unethical? Do you understand what I'm saying? Something which would maybe objectively be unethical, changing the technology on a car. But we, because we have fears of losing our jobs or pressures, we justify it. That is that pretty common?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think self-justification and rationalizing is often how we engage in unethical behavior. I mean, there are really two main contributors to unethical behavior. And one is cognitive load. So stress, like performance pressure, can be one of them. And this is supported by neuroscience and psychological literature. And another is environment. And so I think an important point here is that the unethical behavior we see is more a canary in the coal mine situation. It's a description, it's really indicating a systemic problem of organizations that value products more than people and productivity more than the people they employ. And I think in these cases, you reap what you sow. I mean, this is the environment that is cultivating the cheating behavior.
And that's actually echoed by this comment from Mel Fugate, professor of business at Southern Methodist University. This sounds like exactly what he's talking about.
It affects performance in many ways. So if it affects your performance as an individual employee, that obviously affects the performance of your coworkers, your boss, your unit, your larger organization. And again, if the incidence is so high, this is happening in many places every day.
And Marie, that's an interesting question, is to what extent workplace culture contributes to either supporting or discouraging unethical behavior. How does a workplace create a culture that doesn't encourage that?
Yeah, Mel's absolutely right. There's quite a bit of research that has demonstrated the importance of climate and culture and organizational infrastructures. And what's unfortunate is that when organizations, managers within them, and employees succumb to these types of pressures to continuously compete, sustain profitability, they often turn a blind eye on how those things get done. And it gets normalized within organizations that employees who are new sometimes often don't know or unaware of the steps that have been taken out that are appropriate to maintain their behavior in an ethical manner. And so it does very much happen to where organizations get caught up and the individuals within them perpetuate the unethical behavior, and it's a vicious cycle.
And it's difficult, Karen, I would imagine, to create a balance between trying to motivate people by healthy competition as opposed to taking that too far to where it encourages unethical behavior. Are there ways that a manager or a CEO can do that, can maintain that balance?
Mm-hmm. I think there's modeling. You know, there's a modeling of demonstrating the broader values of creating a good within an organization. There's a showing that you value the individuals that you work with. I think in these cases where we see cheating, like that are discussed in the paper, these are situations where people are trying to regain some sense of autonomy, regain some sense of control, that they're valued. And I would even say that in some ways it's more rewarding than participating as kind of more of a robot or in service of an employer.
And Marie, did you end up being surprised by the results of this research?
No. They're pretty much supported by theory. I have done follow-up work on performance pressure, investigating it across time, day to day, at multiple times a day. Because let's face it, I don't cheat. I am under pressure. There's a lot of individuals who are under pressure and they don't cheat. And so it was really important for me and my colleagues to kind of unpack what really triggers one employee to cheat and to engage in bad behavior where another doesn't. And as Karen noted, there are stressors that happen. And so day to day, employees handle stress differently. And the critical thing that we're finding for managers to focus on is diffusing the threat associated with performance pressure. Because what research has also found, as you alluded to, is if you don't give any kind of little nudge or pressure to employees, their productivity can stagnate
yeah.
too. So it leaves employees in a really prickly position and managers. How do you pressure without eliciting bad behavior?
Yeah, it's...
And so the critical thing that we have found is to get employees to see it as challenging, to
right.
provide them the right infrastructures to where they can learn in an appropriate manner, be
right.
challenged
without,
by it.
Without it being encouraged to engage in unethical behavior.
Exactly.
That's, right. That's Marie Mitchell, professor of management in the Terry College of Business at UGA. And Karen Rommelfanger is a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Emory University. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, a bittersweet retirement for an icon in Atlanta's LGBT community. First, though, more teens live on the streets than ever before. We'll explain why. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Atlanta's homeless youth population is growing, and nationwide, more than 1 million children and teens now live on the streets. New research from Georgia State indicates a number of our hurdles. These young people face a number of hurdles, and often those include untreated mental health conditions and a lack of a support network. With me to discuss this is Anna LaBoy, a research associate at Georgia State University. Hi, Anna.
Hi.
And also Brandon Attell, research associate at the Georgia Health Policy Center. Hi, Brandon.
Good morning, Celeste.
So, Anna, let's start with what we know about why there's an increase in the number of teens and preteens who are now living on the streets?
So there's a lot of different reasons that youth are homeless. So that includes something from financial reasons, right? Something could have happened with their parents. They could get out of situations where they have family problems. We do have mental health and addiction issues, of course. For LGBT youth in specific, it's more likely that they're being kicked out of their homes for their LGBT status. And we do see an uptick in this particular region, especially in the South, with LGBT youth. In our study, we found significantly more LGBT youth than we were expecting. So it was a higher percentage of LGBT youth than from the population.
Well, let's hear from one of them. Timothy Kako lives on the streets of New York as a teenager. That went on for 7 years. And she's describing why it is harder when you're homeless and gay.
When you're gay and homeless and it's obvious that you're a part of the LGBT community, you get discriminated on hard. It's scary. It took a very big toll on me emotionally. I never got like full hours of rest. I would doze off, wake up, check my surroundings, doze off, and it was just constant.
So Brandon, why are so many homeless young people coming to Atlanta? Because many of the homeless young teens and preteens that are here are not from this area. Why are they coming here?
I think based on the people that we talked to a couple summers ago, there are a few reasons. I think Atlanta is seen for a lot of people as somewhat of the Mecca of the South. If you think about people who are on the streets, there's also some climate issues, right? Atlanta is typically a little bit warmer than other major areas in the country. But there is also a big industry that's booming in Atlanta. So there are kind of flexible jobs that people can take up in the film industry that's booming in Atlanta. And there's also a lot of the youth that we spoke with saw Atlanta as a city of opportunity, especially a lot of them wanted to go into careers in music and film and things like that. And they saw Atlanta, there was this overwhelming perception that Atlanta, there was a lot of opportunity. And interestingly, there was also a pretty high perception that Atlanta was a city that had a lot of resources for homeless individuals.
But as it ends up, Anna, just being homeless means that these kids are even in more danger. I mean, Atlanta is a bad place for sex trafficking, but there's other issues as well. Through your research, you discover that they're lacking a number of important things that might help them get off the streets. What are they lacking?
So we're lacking a lot of youth-specific resources. So one issue that we have is all federal funding for homeless services come from the annual point-in-time count that is done on every odd-numbered year, so 2015, 2017, and youth are systematically undercounted in that. And so we
why?
Because youth are more transient, so they're more likely to move. They're more likely to be homeless in ways that we don't think of homelessness. They're in hotel motels. They may be couch surfing. They're usually not with the adult population. If you think of yourself between 14 and 25, do you want to hang out with a 45-year-old?
Nope.
Probably not. And so they're harder to count because they're more transient, because they're more hidden, and because of the low numbers, that's also why we have low funding for youth services in general.
So, and there's a particular problem in Atlanta. Here's Rick Westbrook. He's the executive director of Lost and Found, and he says it's bad in this city because we've closed down so many shelters. We talked to him about the shuttering of the Peachtree Pine shelter earlier this year.
To close Peachtree and Pine before something's actually in place is ludicrous. I mean, let's be honest. Where are these people going to go? They're literally lined up on the streets right now. Peachtree and Pine was not the most effective solution. It was run very poorly for several years. But that's the one place you knew you could go that you could get some type of service.
And Brandon, if Anna is saying that we undercount youth that are homeless and we're closing down shelters, what needs to happen? What are we needing to provide to homeless teens to make sure they don't become homeless adults?
So part of that in Atlanta is we have housing challenges. So we have a lack of affordable housing throughout the city. And I mean, I think most people agree with this. If you drive around the city, you see developments that are going up. So if you think about homelessness at a very raw, basic level as a lack of a house, there's not places for people to affordably be able to stay. So that's one thing, is that we definitely need affordable housing to be addressed throughout the city. But there is also, I think, just more supports as a safety net in general. As Rick was mentioning, it's kind of like, where are these people going to go? Is there a capacity for people to, if there's this major shelter in Atlanta that's been shut down, are they going to stay on the streets, or is there a capacity throughout other kind of safety net shelters throughout the city for them to take those youth in?
And what's the difference? I mean, do shelters take in both adults and kids? How do you keep homeless teens safe if they're in the same place with the adults?
So it depends on the shelter. So some shelters will take in youth specific, so they'll have a specific age range. Some shelters will only take in adults, or they'll take in people of a certain age. So it all depends on their funding specifically and what population they serve.
And in this research, you're looking specifically at the kind of support that they're missing. Does it matter how long a teenager or preteen, a kid, is on the street in terms of what kind of resources they have?
Mm-hmm. So youth who are on the street for longer periods of time, of course, are going to have lower social support networks because they're further along from their social support, right? So if you're on the street, you're less likely to be talking to your family. And so we do want to capture teens early, or youth early, in order to get them off the street and to get them into something that's more sustainably housed.
And in the minute and a half that we have left, Brandon, is this a chicken and egg scenario? Which comes first, the support resources or the shelters?
Oh, that's a tough one. I think you have to have both, right? The support thing is interesting because what the body of literature shows is that actually when youth in general, or youth specifically, become homeless, they actually regenerate their social support networks. So the people that they were once in contact with, their family, maybe their friends that they were going to school with, having class with, those people tend to not be as strong of a presence in their life anymore, and they're actually regenerating these networks out on the street. I think that you have to have interaction across multiple systems to kind of reap the most benefit of the potential of getting out of that situation, getting into a really strong housing situation where you're off the streets. And so I think that you have to have this, you get benefits from both. So there are going to be things from social support networks, the various types of social support you can get that will help out with these other kind of housing, shelters, and things like that. So I think that you need both.
That is Brandon Attali. He's a research associate at the Georgia Health Policy Center, and Anna LaBoy is a research associate at Georgia State University. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Another threat facing homeless youth is the risk of being trafficked. Children often experience sexual abuse and violence at home before they end up in the hands of traffickers. The FBI says child sex abuse cases are at near epidemic levels. The agency has a child exploitation task force with units scattered all across the country, and the largest is in Atlanta. I talked about this in 2015 with Special Agent Eric Pauly. He supervises the FBI's Violent Crimes Against Children Squad in Atlanta. And also joining us was Nancy Chandler, formerly of the Georgia Center for Child Advocacy.
Can I go first, Eric, and ask you about this word epidemic, which implies infection, right? That it's communicable. Why does that word fit here?
Well, it's what we find here in Atlanta and nationwide, as I was the national program manager over this threat for FBI prior to my position here in Atlanta, is that we are finding more and more of this across the country, not just here in Atlanta, but small cities across the country, as well as the large metropolitan areas as well. What we're finding over the course of the last 12 years is really we're finding more and more of this now.
It's growing.
It's growing, but partially I think that is because the emphasis on law enforcement looking for it has increased over those years as well. Therefore, we're looking more, we're finding more, but more attention is in the general public is being paid attention to this fact that it's occurring here in the United States. And this just isn't an international problem that happens in other countries and other third world countries, that it's actually happening here in the United States.
Now, you guys said there was a near epidemic levels of child abuse. Is most of that child abuse you're talking about sex trafficking?
In this crime thread, it has to do with the sexual exploitation. So these children are being exploited by the traffickers or the pimps, and they're being forced to engage in sex acts with much older men multiple times a day, anywhere from 5 to 10 to 15 times a day. And these traffickers are the ones that are benefiting financially from this. So yes, these children are going on an ongoing cycle of sexual abuse.
Nancy, is there a typical victim profile? I mean, everyone likes to think, well, that's really sad, but that's not my kid.
Well, I think that's what everybody wants to think, is that this is happening to somebody who doesn't look like me. But the fact is that the vast majority of kids, there is absolutely no way of saying that, you know, it's a white child, it's a child of color, it's a, you know, 18-year-old, 17-year-old, 12-year-old. I mean, the children who are sexually abused, certainly in our community and across the nation, come from every walk of life, every religious affiliation, every socioeconomic.
Using drugs or not?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, I think the one thing we know about kids who have trafficked is the vast majority of those kids were first sexually abused in their own homes. So they didn't just, you know, wake up one day and say, hey, I'm going to run to Atlanta and be trafficked. I mean, these are kids who have experienced significant abuse in their own homes. Sometimes that's what they're running away from, and they think, I'm going to run to the big city and, you know, it's going to be nirvana. But I think that's the one thing that sometimes we miss in the equation of looking at trafficking is how often this is perhaps the last iteration of the abuse that these children have suffered.
So, Eric, Nancy just talked about that you can't really have a profile of a victim, but what about an offender? Is there a profile of an offender? How do they, I mean, often these are young boys often that get pulled into luring the girls. So how do they get pulled in?
It also varies. Just like on the victim front, there's different factors into it. But on the offender front, the trafficker, the pimp, we've certainly seen recruitment by young traffickers in high schools throughout the country. But it could also be a very traditional old school pimp who's much older, maybe in his 50s and his 60s even. So it really spans the gamut here. It's not one specific age group or one specific demographic. It really spans the scope. So it's very difficult to identify and target a certain demographic on the offender front as well, because they can come in all different means.
Eric, looking at some of the statistics, I travel a lot. There's a chance I walked by a young woman who is being trafficked in the airport or somewhere in a major city. I came from D.C. I probably have. What did I not see? What should I have recognized? Is there anything to look for?
Well, it's very difficult these days, particularly because of the internet. This has allowed the advertisement to take place where it's not generally seen, where, you know, 10, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, you would see people on the street. You might see children on the street, work in a street corner. Not to say that that doesn't still exist, but it is diminished quite a bit. Now, it's a lot
more. They don't have to be on the street corner. They
right.
can advertise it through.
Right. And they can work out of their apartment, their home, the pimp's apartment, or travel to hotels or homes to meet with clients. So, the online aspect of it certainly has changed it. You're right. You may have encountered these victims don't, you know, wear a sign. They're, you know, really what is, you know, kind of some of the indicators people can look at is, are they traveling with older men? Are they really kind of in control by those men? A lot of times victims won't, you know, they'll look down at the floor. They won't make eye contact with other men. They won't communicate with other men. Everything is very controlled by the pimp or the trafficker. So they may also see them traveling in small groups, 4 to 5 girls with one older male.
Nancy, I mean, other than just being horrified by this story, which I am, how else do we stop this? What can somebody who's not in the FBI do?
Well, I mean, I would start at the most basic level, which is for every adult should get training in preventing child sexual abuse. We have a statewide initiative where we provide stewards of children training across the state. We've trained right now, I think, 65,000 adults across the state of Georgia through our initiative on the stewards program. So that just kind of that can help stop child sexual abuse at the beginning, before, you know, before a child...
Before the child runs away.
Before the child is ever abused, you know, we teach folks how to set up safe environments for children, what to look for. If a child does say something to you, how to respond. You know, if a child says something, you know, mom or aunt, you know, somebody, you know, kind of touched me, you don't want the parent freaking out, you know, because children look at you to see what your response is going to be. So that would be where I would say the first stop is to have the training and learn how to prevent this from ever happening. But beyond that, I think it is so important. It's the whole, I mean, we keep talking about see something, say something, and we're talking about everything from, you know, packages left at bus stops to, you know, everything under the sun. But you know, if you are checking into a hotel, you know, you're talking about traveling a lot, and you see a much older man and a younger girl, and that child looks scared, and there's no mom around or aunt, you know, it could certainly be absolutely okay, but, you know, say something to the desk agent and say, can you check on this a little bit? You know, we all have to be involved.
That was Nancy Chandler, formerly with the Georgia Center for Child Advocacy, and FBI Special Agent Eric Pauley. Just ahead, how the power of voice brings communities together. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. Tomorrow we talk with Tion Watkins. You may know her as T-Boz, the lead singer of the group TLC. T-Boz has a new memoir out. It's called A Sick Life. So join us for that conversation. And what is the best TLC song? Call us and let us know at 404-500-9457 or find us on Twitter at OST Talk. Lead poisoning is a big problem in this nation, and young kids are more vulnerable to lead because their bodies absorb 4 to 5 times as much of the toxic metal as adults. In some Georgia cities, children show lead levels greater than those found in Flint, Michigan 3 years ago. 1 in 5 kids tested in downtown Savannah had dangerously high levels in their blood. That's according to a recent Reuters investigation. And in another Savannah zip code, the levels were more than 3 times those found in Flint. Michael Pell is a data reporter for Reuters. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
So how did you get this data?
So last year, after the Flint story broke, my reporting partner and I, Joshua Schneer, were working on a story in East Chicago where housing project was being evacuated. We wanted to determine if that specific housing project had had a long-term problem with lead poisoning. And we obtained census tract level data from the state of Indiana. So we went to other states after we published that story. We went to other states across the country asking for similarly granular data and found out that most states were only releasing countywide data. And that data can actually do more harm than good by making it look like an area doesn't have a problem.
Because of the laws of averages, when they're only releasing countywide,
right,
there's too many kids in the pool.
That's exactly right. And so you might, countywide, you might be doing very well, but what you're missing is specific neighborhoods or cities that have a huge problem. And so we went on a kind of an epic open records quest for this data, and many states provided the data very quickly. And some states, like the state of Georgia, said, nope, we're not going to provide this to you because it violates HIPAA privacy rules. And this despite the fact that the CDC and other states were making this type of information available. So we eventually obtained this data from the CDC, went back to the state of Georgia Department of Health, and they said, okay, well, now that you have it, we will provide you with our own blood lead level testing results. And so that's how we obtained this information and were able to make it available to the public.
So just real quickly, because I know we've all heard a lot about lead since the Flint scandal, can you explain again why lead is so toxic and why it's so dangerous for kids in particular?
Sure. So lead is a heavy metal that has no place in the human body. And over the last couple of decades, researchers have found that even low levels, what was suspected to have been safe in the past, really is not safe at all. It's a neurotoxin that can have a variety of effects on the body, but specifically, as you were saying, in small children, it can be particularly pernicious because their brains and nervous systems are still developing. And so what researchers have found is that even low levels of lead can cause permanent learning disabilities, impulse control problems, reading difficulties, a variety of problems that the kids take with them for the rest of their life, can take with them.
Let's hear this comment. This is Leanne Walter. She's the mother of twin five-year-old boys in Flint, and those kids both suffer from short-term and long-term effects of lead exposure, and she's speaking to CNN here.
They both have hand-eye coordination issues, and their speech is severely impaired, and they're being retaught all these things now. Gavin's not growing properly. He's 39 pounds and almost 6 years old.
So what kind of response have you gotten from people in these communities? I have to assume there's a difference between a resident and the politicians who may or may not be responsible.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes they're the same, same people, unfortunately. We've gotten a variety of responses. When we went to South Bend, Indiana, with our data findings, the mayor said that this was a really big surprise to him. And they were actually they were on the point of running out of funds to conduct testing. The University of Notre Dame stepped in and created a course to test children for lead poisoning and identify the exposure routes. Other communities just feel overwhelmed by the problem. They have a history of decreasing resources available to them to tackle this problem. And like in Savannah, they have a tremendous amount of older housing with lead paint, lead plumbing fixtures that just seems impossible for them to ever deal with this problem.
How many states did you end up looking at?
Ultimately, we obtained data for 32 states and the District of Columbia. Many states don't have data at all. They don't even keep the records of blood lead level testing. Other states kept imperfect records. And some states, like California, provided us partial data, but are reluctant to provide us with the full picture.
And you've said the state of Georgia fought you the hardest to get the data to you? What does that mean?
No, I don't know. No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say that they fought us the hardest, but they did fight tooth and nail. And there were a couple of states like Georgia that said, nope, we're not going to give you this data. And then eventually we had to go around them to the CDC because
right.
These states sometimes report their blood lead level testing results to the CDC. And it was the CDC that recognized, yep, this data is absolutely publicly available. It's paid for by the taxpayers and it should be available to communities so that way they can assess for themselves the problem that they have with lead poisoning.
What do you find is that perhaps the biggest obstacle here? Is it the cost of the testing? I have to assume a big obstacle to solving it is the cost of actually replacing all of these pipes. But is there even enough nationwide, enough resources to test and find out how bad the problem is?
The testing itself is not hugely expensive. It is the response, as you said, to the testing that can be expensive, not just in actually replacing things like lead pipes or removing old lead paint or toxic lead soil from around communities, but also just in determining what is the exposure route for individual children. So as soon as states have to conduct what they call environmental reviews in response to a child with lead poisoning, there is a set cost associated with that. And the more children they go out to and visit, the more expensive that is.
But since it took you guys kind of a great deal of effort to get this information, how much do residents know before they move into an apartment or buy a home about the amount of lead their kids may be exposed to?
Well, I think that residents often don't know very much. I mean, if you're like me, my wife and I moved into an older house in New Jersey with our two small children. We got the boilerplate form about how the house was old and that there could be lead paint there, and that's all you really know. We didn't know anything about our community at large and what the risks were. That's especially problematic if you have a doctor that assumes that they know which kids have lead poisoning and which kids don't. Recent research has found that medical professionals aren't real great at identifying those children, and only tests, blood tests, are.
So is it, maybe it's the, one of the solutions would be to just make lead blood testing universal?
I think that there's a lot of, researchers are looking at that as a potential solution, absolutely. As a matter of fact, the state of California passed legislation last month to increase the number of children who are tested. Several states already require universal testing. Some of them do a pretty good job. Most of them are still struggling to actually get kids tested. I think it's a matter, experts tell us, of getting family physicians to actually take this seriously, to acknowledge the fact that lead poisoning has not been eradicated. Kids are still, hundreds of thousands of kids are still poisoned every year. And that if you want to prevent them from continuing to be poisoned, they need to be tested.
And in the minute that we have left, Michael, that's really kind of the issue here. There is so much news and distraction going on. How do you sort of sound this alarm for kids who may be damaged for the rest of their lives?
That's a good question. I think that that's why we've continued to pursue this story for nearly 2 years, and that there are people that have pursued this for their entire careers. There are organizations that are dedicated to providing clean and healthy homes to children. I think it's a matter of not being distracted by some other issues that come up that might sound sexy for a short time, but are not as pervasive as lead poisoning.
Michael Pell is a reporter for Reuters. He just finished, and it sounds like it's ongoing actually, 2 years of an investigative project to document lead levels in kids all across the United States, and found dangerously high levels in 1 out of 5 kids in Savannah. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Celeste.
Next month, an important member of the Atlanta Gay Men's Chorus leaves the ensemble. Kevin Robison has been the artistic director for 10 years. He recently spoke with GPB's Sean Powers about the legacy he leaves behind.
My name is Kevin Robison. I am the artistic director of the Atlanta Gay Men's Chorus in Atlanta, Georgia. How I feel when I'm conducting the chorus is, of course, a sense of pride. The chorus is, because there are many across the country, were founded in the late 70s. Atlanta was founded in 1981. And during that time, we were about to head into what would become known as the AIDS crisis.
When AIDS first cropped up about 18 months ago, almost all its victims were homosexual males who frequently changed sexual partners. Alarming enough to that particular segment of society, but, so it first appeared, not threatening to the public at large.
The choruses were really there as brothers and a support system for people who were dying of AIDS. I do take a great deal of pride when I'm able to go back and listen to recordings of the group, because my focus is in a different place at that point. This is a piece by composer Eric Whitaker called Lux Aurumque, and it's about light and the colors that he achieves with these cluster chords are absolutely stunning. And to get the right balance for this vibrant light to come out of the music is a real challenge. And when you get it right, which I do think we did in this recording, it's extremely rewarding to know that you've taken the work of a brilliant composer and you've done it justice and brought it to life.
I will never forget. It was one of the high points of my time with the AGMC. It was June 2015, and we were awaiting the Supreme Court decision in the Obergefell case. And the decision came out Friday morning, and of course, the community erupted with joy and relief and celebration, and we had a performance that evening, and that was incredibly powerful to be there with our audience, kindred spirits, to be there with the men of the chorus, to be able to read part of the decision that had just come out earlier that day to the audience was an unforgettable moment for me. When I first began working with LGBT choruses 13 years ago, I very naively said that when we have same-sex marriage equality in this country, there won't be a need for an LGBT chorus. And of course, I learned very quickly that that was not going to be the case, and I knew that long before 2015. Fighting to get to that day was not just something that the choruses did, it's something that all LGBT people and, perhaps more important, our straight allies are the people who made that happen. And so seeing an event like that happen in your tenure with an organization like this really does stop your breath and make you think about the impact that you're having on the community.
That's Kevin Robison. He's the outgoing artistic director of the Atlanta Gay Men's Chorus. He steps down next month. Details on the chorus's upcoming holiday show can be found at gpbnews.org. And that's our show for today. But you know what? We talked earlier about workplace behavior, and we really would love to hear from you. Is there something that you're not proud of, maybe, that you've done at work? Or tell us about the worst thing you've seen someone else do at work. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at OST Talk. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.